So today is the 5th of August 2015. My name is Clara Manassian Cook and I'm here with Richard Jackman in 32 Lincoln's Inn, interviewing him about his experiences of LSE as part of the oral history project for the 120th anniversary of the school. Richard, please can you state your full name for me and your date of birth?
My name, Richard Anthony Jackman, date of birth 1st of January 1945.
When did you first come to LSE?
Well, I think probably it was when I was interviewed. I was in the second category. I was a student at Cambridge, and whilst I was doing my research there, I started on a PhD at Cambridge, where I'd also been an undergraduate, but in my first year as a PhD, I was invited to apply for what then we had assistant lectureships at LSE. I came here, I think, in about March of 1968, and was offered a job. I really didn't know anything at all about LSE before I arrived as a lecturer, as an assistant lecturer. I guess I came here because I was really very honoured to be invited, because I'd got a first class degree from Cambridge, which I hadn't entirely expected, and I hadn't really thought I would have the opportunity to become a university teacher. And so when this job was offered, I jumped at it. I was very pleased to have it, yeah.
What was your first impressions of campus when you first arrived?
Well, coming from Cambridge, it was certainly like being in the middle of a city. Well, it was quite cramped. There were a lot of people around, there were lots of things around, but most importantly that it was surrounded by normal city life and not like Cambridge, a sort of academic, I don't like to use the word backwater, but it somehow, once you get here, other places do seem to be less central, less alive somehow, less buzzy.
And when you first arrived, where were you based on campus?
I was based in a building which was since destroyed, where the Tower One now is. I can't remember the exact name of the building, but it was mainly remarkable because it had a manual lift with a man who pulled the lift up with his hands, which unfortunately was destroyed, of course, when the building was destroyed. It wasn't wholly manual, there was water. It was a metal rope which he pulled, and that released some water which counterweighted the lift, so it was possible for a man to make it move up and down by altering the weight of the water relative to the weight of the people in the lift. Quite a complicated thing. I think something similar works the funicular at Hastings, which is based on having water to counterbalance the weight of the people, so that there's not that one can move up and down without an enormous amount of force. Anyway, it was one of the last such lifts to exist, to still survive in London, maybe in the world, in the 1960s. Yeah.
Did you have a favourite place on campus?
That's right.
Did you have a favourite place on campus?
At the time.
Where you spent most of your time?
No, in those days, unlike now, the senior common room was a very active social gathering outside mealtimes. So in the morning, everybody would go up there for coffee. In the afternoon, everyone would go up there for tea. I don't know when that sort of stopped happening, but certainly to begin with, that's where one would go to meet people. No, I guess my favourite place was the bar, which is in the basement of what is now, well, underneath the Economist bookshop. There was a bar, which was the Three Tuns, which later became underneath the Clare Market building, which is just being destroyed now. But yeah, that was a pretty unattractive place, but it was the only bar that existed within the school, so that a lot of people were there most evenings. Yeah, that was fun.
What was it like working with your colleagues here?
fine. They were. The end of the 60s was an important evolution in terms of the academic life of the school, in the movement away from being a rather inbred sort of parochial sort of college to being somewhere with international aspirations. And at that stage, a lot of there was a real change in the academic atmosphere, that people were. I don't know. One of my you've not interviewed Jim Thomas, have you?
Yes.
Yes, you have. Yeah. So he has these wonderful recollections of after lunch, academics would sort of wander around and go and play tennis or ping pong or something until the pub opened at 5. In those days, pubs couldn't open before 5:30 in the evening, so people would play ping pong or whatever until the pub opened, which is. I guess that's true, that's what happened. It seems a bit strange now. Now everybody is working intensely all the time, producing articles and doing research and generally making it very active. I don't know, the academic life is very externally active. Lots of things being written, conferences, people being interviewed, everything is being happening all the time. By interview, I don't mean like me, I mean new colleagues and things being interviewed, students being interviewed for places, scholarships. So it's really transformed. But in those days, it was very leisurely, I think, being an academic. And it was a very privileged, a small and privileged sector of the economy, the universities. And people didn't really have to do very much. And the students didn't really have to do very much because there weren't terribly many students and they sort of could all float into jobs of one sort or another.
What were the students like that you taught?
Well, in those days, of course, they were very revolutionary because this was the 60s and they were endlessly having demos. And in fact, the school was closed for 3 weeks the first year I was here because of the incident of the gates that... because of all the occupation, it was thought to be a good idea to partition off parts of the school so that they could be sort of shut off, so that even if the school was occupied, certain areas of it could not be accessed by the students. And the students and a few of my colleagues reacted to this by getting great sledgehammers and knocking these things down, which was... Well, it's not only a bit dangerous and inappropriate, but anyway, it's deemed to be impossible to run the school in these circumstances, so it was closed down. Closed for 3 weeks whilst tempers cooled and things were sorted out. Not a very honourable period, really. But it was incited, not actually by that event so much as a few years earlier, by the opposition to the American war in Vietnam, which was spearheaded by the American students who were here, and they had endless disruption going on in protest against the war, even though, of course, Britain wasn't involved in that war. And, yes, the then director, who was Sir Walter Adams, was a rather old-fashioned, inflexible sort of person, couldn't really deal with this very well. One of his successors, well, his immediate successor, Ralph Dahrendorf, on the other hand, was a sort of master strategist and maintained very good relationships with the teachers and the students throughout all the problems that occurred in the 70s while he was, in the early 80s while he was director.
Did this affect your teaching and the students learning from you, in the sense that were they bring revolutionary ideas into the course or
no. not into economics anyway? they lived their life to some extent in two compartments. They thought their long term, their career, they needed a degree, or if they wanted a degree, they wanted to operate in a normal sort of environment, but then sort of like outside that, they also had their politics and they were very active in demonstrations and publicity. And there was a lot of... there was just a very pronounced undercurrent of student rebellion going on all the time. But no, I mean, normal teaching was perfectly okay. Nothing happened. I mean, the exams weren't disrupted or anything like that. And no, they were fairly openly, not exactly schizophrenic, but they were fairly open about the fact that, notwithstanding they wanted to overthrow the society, at the same time they also wanted to do well within it. And that's fair enough.
Over the years, how has your role changed from when you first arrived to now?
Yes, I was interested in that question. I think in some ways remarkably little. relationship between academics is not at all hierarchical here, and I think maybe less so than in other places, I don't know, but it certainly isn't very hierarchical. And I think the reason for that is because there is the emphasis on research is individualistic. That people write articles and they're valued for what they write and what they do, and that is true irrespective of what one's rank is. The relationship between academics and administrators is also much the same way wherever you are in the academic scale, but also hasn't really changed very much. There are clear areas which academics are basically given their head, where the academics are dominant. They can do what they want within the constraints, and that has always been so. The constraints aren't always exactly clear to the academics, but I don't think they've changed very much. The school will be very emphatic that administrators will not intervene in academic selection, for example. But, as we saw with poor Howard Davis, that you can't really totally differentiate sort of academic criteria from administrative, from managerial, and the fact that the grant which he had agreed the school should accept was about supporting an academic research project. But nonetheless, the belief that the source of the funds was something that was crucially relevant could not be divorced from the fact that, that couldn't be, we couldn't just say, okay, look, this was an academic project, the source of the funds doesn't matter, because the academics won't take any notice of that. Doesn't really work like that. So similarly, we are aware that if a department makes a very unpopular appointment, its funding may be affected.
One of the things that people have mentioned about being at LSE and about that LSE is different in this way than other higher education institutions is that things are very equal here, not as hierarchical. Things are much more democratic. And school-wide, actually, not just among the academics, but amongst the academics and all the other professional staff, and also amongst the students. Is that something that you felt when you first came here, that it was much more democratic and equal?
I think I've been more aware of it as I've been here for a longer time, because you don't quite know what to compare it with. But as you become more senior, you realise that your position basically hasn't changed very much, that your colleagues don't respect you more because you're senior, but only because you've done an article that's interesting, or because the students are keen on your teaching, or something like that. That's what gives you prestige, not anything to do with any structural matter. I think it's swinging away a bit I think the outside constraints, it's more necessary to be able to demonstrate that things are done in accordance with appropriate procedures. There's much, much more legislation that affects everything from employment, the way you treat people, to... And in order to ensure that we comply with all this legislation, that obviously puts more power with the managers and administrators, so that when when the departments, academic departments, were created at the school in the 1960s, the head of each department was then called the convener, and that was in order to emphasise that people were equal and they would just be, someone had to convene meetings, but it was the meetings that had the power, not the convener who convened the meetings. But under Howard's, during Howard's time as the director, conveners were renamed heads of department, and they definitely do now have, and in some cases have used, power. They've just decided what should happen and done it. Whereas I was head of department between 2000 and 2003, and in that time the heads of department, well, the conveners then had very little power. Everything had to be agreed by an appropriate committee. So that has begun to move away. But yeah, I mean, I think the general attitude, as I said before, is that because it's sort of meritocratic more than democratic, I would say. There's not much that. I mean, the academic board is perhaps the most democratic because ultimately decisions on that are based on voting. All members of the academic staff are entitled to vote, and on some matters, like whether we raise student fees, that was the ultimate. Well, it wasn't actually the ultimate. It was a vote in the. There was a vote in the academic board, which was completely split between raising 8,000 or 9,000, and the governors, who had to make the final decision, therefore chose to split the number between. Made 8,500. Fees were set at 8,500. Exactly because the academic board was split between 8,000 and 9,000. But had it had a majority one way or the other, it is very unlikely the governors would have overridden that unless they felt that the school would go bankrupt unless we did one thing rather than the other. And I'm not sure of any instance where the governors have gone against an academic board. I think they would be... just feel it would be inappropriate, a matter which is taken to the academic, doesn't mean they don't make any decisions on anything, but a matter which is taken to the academic board because it's relevant to the school's teaching, research, other academic activities, would vote against that or go against that. So yes, in that sense, it is democratic.
Can you describe to me what the experience of working with the academic board is like what it's like going into the room?
Yes. Okay, well, on most matters, I suppose about somewhere between 50 and 100 of the academics would go to the board. Most of the matter is fairly routine and straightforward, descriptions of what's going on and so on. Sort of smallish academic decisions on departmental arrangements of one sort or another. On contentious issues, yes, you might get 200 or 300 people. Like, I think for the fees issue, there were 300 academics there. The trouble with it is that when there's a big meeting, that people it's obviously not a debate. People stand up and say what they think, and there's basically no discussion. No one changes their mind. Everybody ends up voting with what they. How they thought they would at the beginning. So it's, but still, I mean, at least one is aware of the issues and the reasons why people are deciding as they do. The occasions where, I mean, I think it has been unsatisfactory. Like the most recent issue, which was a significant issue, was taken to the academic board, was the issue of the change in the school dates, the dates of the school terms. And there was a clear difference of opinion between departments, and as far as I know, no one, but the debate didn't alter anything, and the dates. It was agreed that the dates would be changed basically because the bigger departments, including economics, were in favour of it. I don't think that was a particularly impressive demonstration of anything, but I mean, equally, not in this case, but in other cases, it's quite important that some of the bigger departments, which are, tend to be those with the most students and bringing the most money into the school, can sort of get leveraged out somehow of their, you know, their academics typically aren't so terribly keen on academic administration. They tend to get leveraged out of key positions within the school administration, and so bringing in all the academics can provide a counterweight to that. And this was one of the issues in this fees question, that most of the bigger departments were in favour of raising fees, the smaller ones often weren't, because they didn't have many students, and you know they weren't, I mean, they were more sort of compassionate about it, whereas the big ones who had more students because their students were going on to more likely to get into good jobs and so on were typically in favour of raising fees because they were short of money on to provide scholarships and to attract teachers and such like.
So there broadly is a chance for the big departments with lots of students to get together with the small departments who maybe feel they don't always get a say, and there broadly is a chance for them to meet and all have...
Yeah, well, they all have a say, yeah, yeah. No, I think what I'm getting at is when you say it's democratic, that sort of suggests that there's a wide variety of opinions being tossed around and everybody gets an equal weighting. Whereas I'm saying it's democratic in a sort of more populist sense, that there's not much debate and it's not really people discussing things with each other. It's more that there's maybe a distinction between the sort of behind the scenes way that committees work as against the sort of, how to say, the the needs that the weight to be given to differences of opinion within the school ought perhaps to reflect the students. So the big departments with more students ought to get more weight. But in a committee, each department will have one representative, that sort of thing. So that it's a bit more like shareholder democracy, if you think of, you know, that's a good way of thinking. So it's like shareholders, that we have more votes in economics because we have more students. But we only have the same representation on committees as a much smaller department with many fewer students. So you might think, why should at a shareholders meeting, people have the same number of votes as they have shares. It's not one man, one vote. It's one share, one vote. And if you've got lots of shares, you have lots of votes. So it's more, it's recognising, as it were, that the school ought to give more weight to the views of department. But I mean, that's just going to an extreme, which I think the academic board has become more like that, more like a body in which the votes cast reflect student numbers, rather than the committee structure, which also we need one representative from here and one representative from there, and every department has the same weight, as it were. But I mean, it's not entirely like that. I mean, other things. I'm just trying to think of an example of something which was not. Yeah. I mean, for example, there was the last meeting of the academic board I went to was about one of the issues about exams, whether all exams should be double blind marked, which is a procedure which in economics we've always had. Some departments have moved away from it a long time ago, like geography. Other departments are quite keen to move away from it, like law. But those particular views were, you know, to do with the nature of the subject, and basically it was possible to... there was a discussion and there was an agreement that double-blind marking should remain a default, that if You know, if the department didn't make a case for doing something else, it would do that. But if it did make a case, then that case could be reviewed by some committee or other and in general would be approved. So I think the they've not all been sort of rude punch-ups, but it does provide an opportunity for... it does provide an opportunity for academics that may sometimes feel a bit frustrated that they have no say in how things go on in the school. I mean, again, I can only say from my department that the committees on which the economics department is not represented, and you know, if there weren't the academic board, then we would indeed be disenfranchised, or other committees where the people don't, the representative doesn't turn up, and you know, all sorts of things. Yeah, so I agree. So yeah, my belief is that a body like the academic board is not common in universities. That departmental management, most departments in all universities have departmental meetings where all the academics can go, but the power of the departmental meetings is limited because in most universities departments have to go along with whatever is on the university policies on this, that and the other. Yeah.
Throughout your time working here, can you describe to me what some of the main challenges have been?
I think I'm sort of a bit like an actor. I was a stage fright. I find each lecture seems a real challenge. You know, you go there with all these students, and who knows what's going to happen, whether you're going to be successful in interesting them, in persuading them, in talking to them, or whether they're all going to be bored and start walking out and talking to each other. And, you know, you've got to try and ensure that this largest group of students does stay quiet and listen and like understand something, or at least to get something out of it. I've always been a bit nervous about that. What other challenges? No, I mean, I think performance is something which I've always been worried about. So, like, I have written lots of papers, I've presented a lot of conference presentations, but they are also very they're also a bit challenging too. Other than that, I've done a bit of consultancy work, and that is not so much challenging as exhausting, because in outside the academic world, people work to much shorter time horizons. You have to get things done very quickly, and they're used to it and they do it and they know how to do it. But to someone who's, you know, your academics are sort of a bit perfectionist, so try and get everything right. And, you know, if you take a long time to make sure some particular bit is right, and then you've still got masses and masses more things to do. I found that exhausting, but at the same time a bit frustrating, because inevitably what you end up with is something you're not terribly proud of, because it's got... It makes statements which you're not sure you're completely confident of, and so on. I spent a year working at the World Bank, which I like quite a lot, but it did have this problem that we were operating on guesswork much of the time, and you know, there were important things we were having to do, but
Do you feel that's become